Okay, so for this evening's talk, I'm going to talk about samadhi and how I'm going to sort of try to pull together some of the threads that I've been weaving through this retreat, and about how the different aspects of the meditation lead to and constitute the deep meditations that we call samadhi or jhanas, and how that process arises. And when I'm talking about these things, it's interesting for me to kind of reflect that you know, I've been the student of Ajahn Brahm for many years and the student of the suttas since the 90s. And in those days, hardly anybody was really talking about jhanas and samadhi and things like that. It was all vipassana, it was all insight, it was all don't get stuck in these kinds of things. And Ajahn Brahm starts talking about it. And, you know, even when I was, because I started out in this vipassana tradition and I didn't really know what I thought, and I did my own kind of research and contemplation and practice and so on, and ended up writing a couple of books on the subject myself and making some small contributions as much as I can. But it's been interesting to see over the years how the field has really changed, and now jhana's like super popular. In America, they've got like jhana apps. You've got like the jhana bros who are like streamlining it, fast-tracking it. And I feel like, yes, it's a real thing. I feel like I've been sort of part of a thing where, like if you look at like say how like Chinese food gets Americanized and becomes like sweet and sour pork, and it's like not really like anything that existed ever in China. And I feel like in what we've been doing is kind of like the same thing. I mean, we're watching before our very eyes the concepts that are so meaningful and sacred and delicate to us get kind of infused and like deep fried and smothered with ketchup and it's like a curious kind of evolution. But anyway, you do hear a lot. My main point here is that these days, if you sort of look around the kind of the Buddhist sphere, you do hear a lot of people saying a lot of things about jhanas. Not to put too fine a point on it, but most of it's rubbish and you should ignore it. So just putting that out there. But if you want the real stuff, here it is. Of course, Ajahn Brahm's a great teacher of jhanas, and there are, of course, other people as well. But a lot of the stuff that you're hearing is very kind of dumbed down and disappointing to me, because it's one of the things that I try to emphasize, and through like the discussion of the Buddha's context and so on, is to emphasize how powerful these things are. I mean, you know, we're talking about practices that the greatest sages of old would give up everything and go and live in a cave in the Himalayas for decades to practice these things. And, you know, now you've got a bunch of coders sitting around saying, oh yeah, we'll be able to optimize the input output efficiency and get jhanas down, you know, you'll be able to practice for an hour and then get jhanas and these, you know, like, so don't worry too much about these things, and don't get caught up in labels, right? The labels don't really matter, but what matters, of course, is your own process and your own meditation. And what matters is that you are taking a step forward. Yeah? That's really all that matters. Yeah? It doesn't matter how far away the mountain is or whatever, but where is our next step forward? So the reason I'm going to talk about it now is because it helps to have like an overview of like how all these different aspects of the path fit in together and give you a picture of where you're going. So that's what I'm going to talk about now. So jhana is a deep state of absorption in meditation, and it is defined and talked about often in the suttas and the various lists of jhanas, most prominently the four jhanas. And so these, one of the contributions that the Buddha made, I believe, was that, as I mentioned a couple of days ago, the contemplative culture at the time of the Buddha usually talked about contemplative states in metaphysical and theological terms, but the Buddha instead talked about them in psychological and empirical terms. This is, I think, one of the great innovations that the Buddha introduced. So he talked about these deep states of meditation, and he talked about them in terms of the psychological factors that are present and those that are absent. And so that really helps us to understand our own path which of course we can understand without necessarily any reference to any particular philosophical or metaphysical framework. And it is very much the case that you don't have to be a Buddhist to practice deep meditation, and you don't have to be, you don't have to have a commitment to a particular belief system. I'm not saying that belief systems and so on are irrelevant. I'm just saying that they're not necessary for the practice of jhana as such. Now, we have two words commonly used in Buddhism to talk about these states. One is jhana and the other one is samadhi, which you'll hear me talking. So I translate jhana as absorption and samadhi as immersion, both words which have a similar meaning in English. And I do that deliberately because they also have a very similar meaning in Pali or Sanskrit. Interestingly enough, the etymology of the word jhana has really two aspects, okay, both of which are present in the meditation meaning in Buddhism. One aspect of jhana means illumination, okay, it's a light. Yeah, you would walk into this room and say, oh, the candles are jhanaing on the shrine. Yeah? It literally is a glow or an illumination. And I believe that meaning is very fundamental. The other meaning of jhana is a kind of concentration or rumination. So, for example, the cat watching the birds is a really good example. In fact, in Pali, you would say that the cat is jhanaing on those birds, okay? It's sitting there, where are they? And so that aspect of having that kind of intense contemplation and so on, that can also be like that psychological sense of jhana. So the two senses, right? So one is like an intent contemplation and the other is illumination, both of which, they're actually two different words in Sanskrit, but in Pali, they are combined to become one word. I believe, and this is a bit of a historical speculation to be honest, but I believe that the inspiration, like the word jhana is not used in this particular sense before Buddhism, but I believe the inspiration comes from the very famous Vedic verse, the Gayatri Mantra, where the word from the same root of jhana is used in the sense of the light of the rising sun whose radiance wakens the mind and brings the mind towards greater consciousness. And I believe that kind of metaphor was the inspiration behind the meaning of the word jhana. Anyway, so these are two senses of the word jhana. Interestingly enough, the word samadhi also has two senses, which are similar to the word jhana. One of the meanings of the word samadhi is that when things come together. So this is often translated as concentration. So things come together and unify, come together as one. But the other meaning of the word samadhi is to illuminate or to kindle. Like when you kindle a flame, you samadhahati that flame. So you're actually lighting a fire. So they both have these two senses of collectedness, togetherness, oneness, and also illumination, brilliance, light. These are fundamental to the experience of samadhi or jhana. Now, I know some of you in your meditation, in this retreat, have experienced something of these things. You've experienced some concentration of mind, ability to keep with one thing for a period of time. Some of you have experienced the fading away of sense impressions and the quietening of the activity of the mind. And some of you have also experienced the radiance and the light that emerges in different ways during the course of meditation. So these are the experiences that are characteristic of jhana or samadhi. So when jhana is talked about, it's usually defined in terms of five jhana factors. And I'm not going to go into too much detail into like all the stuff. It would be a very long Dhamma talk. But I will talk a little bit about these five jhana factors and about how they are developed and manifested through the metta practice that we have been doing up to this point in time. So the five jhana factors are, in Pali, vitaka vichara piti sukha ekagata. It's application of mind, sustained application, rapture or uplift, joy, sukha is pleasure, and ekagata is unification. And so these five factors are present for the first jhana, or another way of saying this is that the state of mind that we call first jhana is what happens when all of these five factors are fully present and developed and together. And these are things which we are developing through the course of the meditation. And I'm going to talk about the meaning of each one in turn. Okay, so first one is vitaka, which is very closely related to vichara. Now, vitaka and vichara in everyday speech mean thought and examining, or thinking and reflecting. Right? So in an ordinary, everyday consciousness, you would be sitting there having a vitaka about what is going to be for lunch today. And you'd be thinking about, oh, I hope they have this, I hope they have that. Oh, that was good yesterday, and I wonder if they'll have that again. All right? And so this is a vitaka, okay? So any kind of thought can just generally be a vitaka. Generally speaking, though, the way that vitaka is used is more for thought that has a purpose or a direction, rather than simply mindless proliferation, for which we use the word papancha. Okay? So when your mind is just, right? That's papancha, okay? But when your thought is like directed maybe on a particular topic and you're actually sort of, you know, applying yourself to that topic, we call that vitaka. Vichara is basically the same thing, but a bit more kind of extended, a bit more reflective, yeah? So reflecting about something, exploring about something and so on is what we call vichara. So these two factors are the initial two factors of the first jhana. Now, these two factors have been, in my view, needlessly controverted in modern times, because a lot of people think, well, since these words in an ordinary state of consciousness mean thinking and ruminating, therefore they must mean the same thing in jhana. But that's not how, like, anything works. It's certainly not how language works. The meanings of words change depending on their context. And the state that we have now, the state of mind that we have now, is a state of mind which has hindrances and defilements and all of those kinds of things. The state of jhana is a state of adhicitta, higher mind, elevated consciousness. And when the consciousness is elevated, obviously everything to do with that consciousness is elevated. So all of these five words have a something of the same meaning that they have in ordinary language, but an elevated and refined version of that same meaning. That's like the whole point of this. It's not the same as ordinary consciousness. So if you reflect and look more at what that process of thinking and reflecting and so on goes, you see that like even in the English language, you can use the word to think of something in the sense of simply to direct your mind towards something. Right? It doesn't necessarily mean to verbalize about something. In fact, some people don't verbalize at all. Right? I mean, this is weird. I've only discovered this not long ago. Is there anybody here who's like that? Who doesn't actually verbalize in their mind? Some people just like have pictures and things. Anyone here like that? No? Curious. So yeah, apparently so. I don't know, it seems weird to me, but there you go. So and you can see how that process works through the process of metta meditation itself. When we begin the metta meditation, what do we begin with? May I be happy. Yeah, that's a vitaka. Right there is your vitaka, may I be happy, verbally expressed. And that helps to direct and focus your meditation. And the vichara is like the continuation of that and like the reflection on the meaning of it. Yeah. So when you're like, oh, you're aware, oh, that this is a feeling, that meaning of may I be happy, this is a vichara, and sustaining that through. So you're developing these two jhana factors right from the beginning of the meditation. As you go on in the meditation, deeper and deeper, you begin to notice that that feeling of metta becomes prominent, which we'll talk about more in a minute later. And as that feeling becomes prominent, the words start to fade in the background, but the directedness of those words is still there. You're still applying your mind, even though the words themselves are sort of going in the background and ultimately will disappear completely. And if you noticed during the meditation that we just did now with the metta for all beings, and then that's when the words are left behind completely. So with the metta meditation, as in terms of this method, that's where the verbalization of vitakka and vichara ceases completely. But the mind is still directed and sustained in that kind of way. So this is how the mind gradually moves and develops and transcends from ordinary consciousness, ordinary citta, to adhicitta, the higher mind. And all of the factors of meditation and all the dimensions of meditation are the same. Same thing with like the feeling of metta itself. When we first begin, the feeling of metta is fleeting or confused or obscured or whatever. And more we go, you feel that it becomes pure, it becomes strong, it becomes bright, it becomes clear. That's the purpose of meditation. The third one of the jhana factors is piti or rapture. So vitakka vichara, piti. And rapture is a sense of uplift. Rapture is like the zing that you feel in meditation. Rapture is what you don't have when you're feeling bored and cynical and negative about the meditation, right? This is what's missing. Rapture is like the fizz in your champagne. Yeah? That's what gives a little bit of zest to your meditation. Now, when rapture is strong, okay, rapture can manifest in all kinds of ways. Actually, rapture is a kind of an umbrella term. And during the development of meditation, you can feel sometimes like your body might move. Sometimes you start to cry, right? Your emotions come very close to the surface. Or sometimes maybe you'll feel like your hair's standing up on end. Anybody have that during the meditation? Yeah, the hair standing up on end, yeah? So this is considered a form of minor rapture. Sometimes you might feel like your body's really strong, right? Or that you might feel like your body is almost like fixed, like stone. Or you might feel like you're very heavy. Yeah? Or you might feel very light, like you're floating up in the air. You're sitting there and meditating. You're thinking, wow, I'm floating up in the air. Just don't open your eyes, okay? At that point. Okay? And if you're in the room and you see somebody floating up in the air, just like, be kind and put a soft cushion under them just in case there's a rough landing, okay? So these are all the kinds of feelings that you can have, and they're considered sort of within the umbrella category of rapture or piti. But none of them are the real piti that you're looking for samadhi. So these will all come and go, or that they may or may not. Not everyone experiences them in that way. But over time, they will mature, and the feeling of piti that we're looking for is what's called parana piti, or pervading rapture. And this is what we're developing when we're spreading the metta through your whole body. And you can feel that sense of like uplift and energy through your body because of that pleasant feeling of the metta. And that is giving you energy. It's creating an interest in the meditation, and it is like keeping your inspiration going over those long periods of time. So parana piti is very subtle. It's very over time, and it becomes kind of very stable. It's not like a fluctuating thing. Like some forms of rapture you can experience like a bolt of lightning or like electricity or something, and they usually last for a short period of time. But parana piti will last for a long period of time. Why does it last for a long period of time? Because of the vitakka vichara. Vitakka vichara is the spade work that you are doing that is creating the foundation that can sustain your meditation for a long period. Right? Don't neglect it. Do it. The more you do it carefully and systematically, the better a foundation that you're bringing. The same thing is in breath meditation. In breath meditation, the more that you can pay attention to the simple physical feeling of the breath coming in and out, the more you're laying that groundwork for the deep states of meditation that come later. So don't be in a rush. Okay, so vitaka vichara, applying the mind and sustaining that application. Piti, the uplift and rapture. And sukha. Sukha is like the sort of the counterpart of rapture. So rapture itself is rapture itself is like the emotional response to pleasure. Yeah? Rapture is the emotional response to pleasure. Yeah? If somebody buys you an ice cream and says, here you go, you're like, oh, that's nice, right? That's your rapture. It's like, oh, that's nice. The pleasant feeling you have when you have the ice cream, this is the sukha. Yeah? The sukha is the pleasure. And that sukha or pleasure is very close in Pali to the word pasadhi or tranquility. And if rapture is lifting you up, the sukha is settling you down. Yeah? If the rapture is the zing, then the sukha is the sweetness. Yeah? And so the sukha is like settling down through all of your limbs, through all of your cells, through all of the pores of your body. You still feel it in an embodied sense, but has a richness to it. Yeah, has a richness to it. And so now the piti, the vitaka vichara piti sukha, the application of mind, sustaining of mind, the zest or uplift, and the sukha. Now the sukha. The pleasure, the practice of metta meditation is one of the best ways of developing the experience of sukha in meditation, okay? It is essential, it's essential for all of us in a meditation to find a way to get contact with that rapture and that bliss, those positive, overflowing, joyous emotions, to be able to feel those in our meditation. We have to set out on a journey to be able to feel those things. Metta meditation, tuvatang chittang samadhiyati, the Buddha said. Yeah, so it leads the mind quickly to samadhi because of that sukha in the meditation. If, you know, we're now approaching near the end of the retreat and you've all given it a good go and given it a good shot for this meditation, if you find at the end of the retreat that metta meditation is not giving you any sukha or whatever, that's okay. There are plenty of other meditation methods. But generally speaking, sukha is a really good way of doing it. In my own personal practice, I first began doing like the vipassana practice, which is basically purely dry, like only equanimity. And then I started doing some breath meditation. Having been conditioned by a lot of the vipassana practice, I found it really difficult to find any kind of pleasure in the breath meditation, and it was just very dry. And it wasn't until I started doing some metta meditation that I began to say, oh, wow, yeah, you can actually feel these things. They're not, oh, well, they're just not just making it up, you know. These aren't just empty words. These are genuine experiences. And later on, when I came back to the breath meditation, I found that it was very easy to experience that sukha and that rapture through the breath meditation. You know, my mind had, I'd been sort of trained my mind to be able to tune in on that dimension. Yeah. Honestly, that's a lot of what it is. And I promise you, even if you've been struggling and haven't been able to experience these things, I promise you those experiences are real and they are within you. And it's just a matter of patience, gradual, 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 and tuning in. And one day, then something will release, something will open, something will show itself to you, and you'll feel that, and you will know, oh, that was there all along. Yeah. And once you know how to do that, you'll be able to find your way back very easily. It's not difficult. It just needs to be, you just need to find your way to it. And once you can open up, you'll be able to find that joy and that happiness. And if you can find it through the metta meditation, you'll be able to bring it into the breath meditation or whatever other practice you're doing as well. So the final one of these jhana factors is the factor of ekagata or unification. And I'm going to talk about this just for a few minutes because it's another one which is, in my view, needlessly controverted within the Buddhist tradition. Within, I think, modern Buddhist tradition, I don't think in the past generations of Buddhists were so confused about it. So in the main formula for the first jhana, when the Buddha talked about this. This is a meditation teaching which is found hundreds and hundreds of times in the early Buddha suttas and which is repeated verbatim, literally word for word, without any variation across all of the Tibetan and Chinese and Sanskrit and other Buddhist scriptures. It's one of the most fundamental Buddhist passages and begins vivicce vakamehi, vivicce akusalehi damehi, which means quite secluded from kamehi, from the senses, quite secluded from unwholesome properties, unwholesome qualities. So those unwholesome qualities are the qualities of greed, hatred, and delusion, the five hindrances, and so on. But the meaning of the first term is, again, a bit controversial, or people have different opinions about it. But what it really means is quite secluded from the senses. Actually, in Pali, when the word karma is used in this sense, in a plural sense, it means sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. And so we're being secluded from sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. I'm going to go into a bit more of the Buddhist philosophy of the senses and sense experience from tomorrow. We're going to be talking about insight practice tomorrow. But just let me just say a couple of things about this today. First thing about sense experience is that sense experience requires attention. It doesn't just happen. It's not just a kind of a neutral thing, right? There has to be an actual turning of the mind to experience those things. And I'm sure we've all had cases where somehow you didn't know something was going on. Maybe you were absorbed in reading a book or something and somebody came home and you didn't even hear the door or something like that. That kind of thing happens all the time. Why? Because you're not paying attention. What in meditation, when your mind is going deeper and deeper in meditation, your mind is becoming more and more absorbed in that inner experience of metta or whatever else that we're doing. And that inner experience is manifesting as the nimitta, as the sign of meditation. And as you are going deeper and deeper into that, absorbing into that and immersing into that, then your experience of the senses is correspondingly fading. Little bit by little bit by little bit going down. Now, for quite a while in meditation, it is the case that that maybe those experiences are soft or are quiet, but they're kind of still there. So you're not actually hearing things around you, but if somebody knocks on the door or something, then you'll still, you know, your attention will be drawn towards it. But in deep meditation, that's no longer the case. So in deep meditation, in jhana or samadhi, the mind truly becomes one and all of that sense activity ceases. This is the path of gradual cessation. This is one of the things that the Buddha, that's one of the meanings of jhana or samadhi. It's the whole point of it is to show you that the cessation of consciousness is blissful. Those things that we thought were providing us with pleasure, sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, when they end, we experience a kind of pleasure which is beyond anything we could possibly have imagined. That's the point. That's the point of this whole practice. Now, I understand the word, when the Buddha talked about unification, I think we can tease the meaning of that word out to have a number of different senses. First sense is it means unification of consciousness. And that means that instead of the six consciousnesses, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mind, five of those are gone and we only have the mind consciousness. Yeah? Mind consciousness only. That's one meaning of ekagata. Another meaning of ekagata is one-pointedness in time. The Buddha talked about impermanence. All things are impermanent. Okay, fine. But when we understand impermanence on a shallow level, we kind of understand impermanence as something that happens to things. You know, you have a building and over time it gets worn by the wind and the rain. So impermanence is something that things are subject to. But when the Buddha talked about impermanence, he meant something rather more subtle and meaningful than that. One of the aspects of that is that it doesn't just happen to be the case that consciousness is impermanent. Rather, change is how consciousness works. Think about it. Think about how that goes, right? If you are, let's say you are, again, maybe you're sitting at home and it's a quiet night and nothing around is happening and so on, and then you hear a sound, yeah? Everything is the same, and so you weren't paying any attention to it. But consciousness actually is the consciousness of change. And when you hear that sound, and anything that you hear, if it's constant, it falls out of your consciousness. You know, maybe there's a background hum in the room. You know, after a while, you just ignore it. You don't notice it. Somebody walks in and says, "What's that hum?" And you say, "What hum?" And so consciousness is stimulated by change. It's part of the nature of consciousness. So in the jhana, state of jhana or samadhi itself, that stops, more or less. So basically, your consciousness becomes still or becomes frozen in time. Like, not necessarily totally, but mostly it becomes like that. And what that means, and that's the experience which in the theological traditions they call the eternal present or the eternal now. It feels like an eternity. In a way, it is an eternity because time is no longer operating. And when you're in that state, you've got no, like the idea of time is just gone because there's no changes of your consciousness to measure time against. So this is two aspects of and one-pointedness, one-pointedness of consciousness, one-pointedness in time. Another dimension of unification is in terms of the balance and integration of all of the jhana factors. So part of the meaning here is that when we are developing our meditation, and when each one of you has developed the meditation in this retreat, then you have developed the thought, may I be happy? You've developed the reflection and the knowledge of may I be happy, this is the vitaka and vichara. And hopefully you've also had an experience of the rapture, the feeling of uplift, yeah, and maybe experience of the pleasure of that meditation and so on. But we experience those things maybe coming and going, maybe drifting in and out a bit, maybe now weaker, now stronger, and so on. And so at different times, we might experience different aspects of that meditation. And we can also experience the different aspects of the meditation sometimes as being like in tension with each other. So some people might feel like, oh, I've had that really blissful feeling of metta, and I felt like the words of metta were kind of annoying, right? That was kind of ticking in the background and so on. So you feel like the factors are kind of not really meshing with each other completely yet. So this is a lack of one-pointedness and lack of ekagata. When there is unification, all of those things come together and all of them are in perfect balance and harmony. And that's when they manifest their true strength. The true strength of unification, it doesn't necessarily mean something that is overt or obvious. The true strength is extremely subtle and extremely refined, but utterly immovable. So that when all of the factors sort of we're trying bit by bit by bit by bit, and gradually they kind of settle in together, and gradually they lock in together in place. And it's just one thing. And you begin to realize that actually all of these factors really are there, obviously are just different aspects of your mind. And normally the way the mind works is that it's a bit kind of disorganized, a bit dysfunctional, a bit scattered, and everything's over the place. So that's what we're doing in meditation. You're realizing that all of these things, which in and of themselves are very ordinary, thinking is ordinary, reflecting is ordinary, happiness is ordinary. These are ordinary things. But we've developed them, these basic ordinary psychological properties of the mind, to a point where we realize that they can lock together in this one thing. And they become just the mind, which is transformed. And that is another meaning of the word ekagata. So when we're talking about these states, we're talking about something which is very profound. When a Christian meditator practices and they have this experience, they'll come out and say, I saw God. Yeah? In which case everyone will say, oh, they're a great saint. Or maybe they'll say, I have become God. In which case I'll burn them at the stake. But the same thing in, like, in Hinduism, right? This is where the Hindus will come out and they'll say, oh, I became Brahma. I realized the divinity of the cosmos. It's a profound transcendent experience. And you know what? The Buddha would agree with him. It's literally what the Buddha said. The Buddha said that if you practice these states of meditation, you get, this is a Brahma Viharas. It's the word the Buddha used from it. It's the meditations of Brahma. So you practice these meditations, you literally become God in your next life. God isn't quite what we think God is, to be sure. God's still impermanent. It's not enlightened or anything like that. Still, it's not too shabby, all things considered, right? So the Buddha is actually, you know, in the metaphysics and how we interpret it is different, but the basic idea is still there, that these are transcendent experiences which lift you above the human plane to realize a dimension of consciousness which is beyond anything which we have experienced. That experience is a natural capacity of the human mind. Another, to my mind, I'm mentioning a lot of what I think are needless controversies tonight, but another needless controversy in Buddhism is about whether the radiance of the mind is natural. And you hear this is something which is quoted all the time. People say the mind is naturally radiant and so on and so forth. It's not actually what the sutta says or what it means. In Buddhism, the mind is what the mind is neither naturally pure and radiant or naturally corrupt and defiled. The mind is naturally conditioned. Mind is like water. Is water naturally pure or is it naturally dirty? Well, it depends. Right? Sometimes water is pure, sometimes it's dirty. It's the condition. So your mind is neither naturally pure nor naturally conditioned, naturally pure nor naturally defiled. Your mind is naturally conditioned. But within that lies the assumption that your mind has the potential to transform itself. Right? That is something which is within each one of us. So I know that when I'm talking about this and I'm talking about these things, you know, many of you may be thinking, oh, this is it's very kind of high Dhamma or this is whatever. Don't worry about it. I can't prove this to you. Okay, I can't if I could open up your skulls and like inject some jhana in there, then I would do so. And I'm sure the jhana bros will figure out a way to do that at a certain point. All right, but we can't do that. So we have to take these things to a certain degree on faith. Yeah. So we can have our own experience, and that teaches us something. And then until we've experienced for ourselves, then we have to live on faith to some degree. But that faith is confirmed by our journey when we see things for ourselves. So each person has the potential to realize these things. When we realize them in Buddhism, this is the completion of the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the eighth factor of the Eightfold Noble Path, which is, you of course will all remember, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right? Sorry? Livelihood. Effort. Effort next. Very good. Excellent. You're just ahead of your time, that's all. Yeah. Effort, right? Mindfulness. And the last one, right? Samadhi. Yeah? Well done. Yeah, you remembered. Okay, so that's good. So this is now completing all of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. However, in order to be right samadhi, okay, it has to go with all of those factors, starting with right view. So I mentioned before that you don't have to be a Buddhist to practice jhana or practice samadhi. It's very true. You can be a Hindu or a Muslim or have no religion or whatever. It doesn't really matter. You can practice and you can realize these states of mind. But it's the right view which then informs how you see that experience. If you start out with the view that the divinity of the mind is the true cosmos, which is the eternal Brahman, you'll meditate, you'll see that, and that's how you will see that, and that will be your realization from that. And that's what the Buddha was taught by his former teachers before he realized enlightenment. But the Four Noble Truths tell us that, well, even this experience, right, even this blissful, sublime, transcendent experience ultimately is impermanent. Ultimately is dukkha, suffering, conditioned. And so when you emerge from that experience, since your mind is informed by that view of the Four Noble Truths, you reflect back on it and you ask yourself, why? Why was that blissful? Why? What actually made that be like it was? And again, this is why I'm constantly urging you to do a reflection at the end of every meditation. Yeah? So you get in the habit of doing that and you're awakening that curiosity so that when you have a deep meditation, you come out of it, you look back and you think, what the hell was that? Why? Why was the mind so free? Why was the mind so blissful? Or, alternatively, why the hell isn't like that all the time? One of the things that's really characteristic of samadhi experiences is that even though it's such a powerful and unique and transformative experience, it feels like coming home. It feels like it's just, oh, finally everything's working like it should. You know, it feels like you've been driving this car around that's been out of tune and without any oil or something like that your whole life. And then you have a kind friend who says, hang on, give me a minute. And then they tune it up and fix it up and change the oil. And you start it and it's really smooth. And you're like, wow, oh, why isn't it being like that all the time? And you'd be like, why aren't I just like, and you almost like think, oh, this is just how it's going to be. And, you know, your mind, like, why would you go with all of these defilements and hindrances and stuff like that when you can just be free of them? Yeah. Of course, it doesn't take long and they start coming back after a while. So, but you reflect back and you understand, it's a cessation, the ending of these different hindrances, ending of different defilements, ending of greed, hate, and delusion, or ending of whatever has ended. Senses, all of these things have ended and these beautiful, pure dhammas have manifested through that. And so this is how that process of insight emerges in the culminating parts of the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is right samadhi of the Noble Eightfold Path. So anyway, that's a few words for this evening on jhana and samadhi and the role in the Buddhist path.